It's 7:30 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Beth Voorhees. In Wheeling, Brandon Holmes is working to build a unique farmer's market.
We want farmers to be able to come, drop off what they've grown, and not only farmers, but also backyard gardeners, market gardeners, those people that have, you know, an extra half a bushel of tomatoes or zucchini or something that they really did well on. We want them to be able to drop those products off here.
The story coming up on this West Virginia morning. Last month, Danny Webb Construction began shutting down above-ground pits in Fayette County that held oil and gas waste that likely came from horizontal drilling operations. In a more recent development, the DEP says a tank that was holding some of that waste leaked during the process, which was cleaned up. Citizens have been expressing concern about this particular operation for years. Environmental groups ran some tests last year, and while results have turned up inconclusive, it's still raised red flags. Jessica Lilly reports.
Back in January of this year, we first reported about the worrisome oil and gas waste site that used above-ground pits to first remove sediments before injecting the waste into an underground injection well in Fayette County. While the state's Department of Environmental Protection found no evidence that an above-ground waste pit had been leaking, the regulatory agency said the pit was at risk and asked the site owner, Danny Webb Construction, to bring it up to standard. DEP says the company began to close those pits in May. So what was in the pits? For that answer, let's get some help from the experts. Mark Glass with Downstream Strategies is familiar with the site and was even hired to collect samples and analyze data a little over a year ago. The company's permit to collect oil and gas waste requires a certain amount of self-testing to verify that the substances collected were indeed the type of waste permitted for disposal. Glass shared data collected for the DEP, but it's not clear if the company or the agency collected the samples. Glass says two things are certain. One, the samples were taken from the waste pits twice in 2009 and once in 2013. And two, the DEP had access to the results.
And you find them, as would be very typical with oil and gas waste, to be elevated in barium, iron, manganese, and have very low pHs. And also some benzene, and benzene, ethyl benzene, xylenes.
Glass explains that the pit contained BTEX compounds. It's an acronym used to identify benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylene, or volatile organic compounds, typically found in petroleum products such as gasoline and diesel fuel. Now, BTEX, Glass explains, are all chemicals that can occur naturally.
Think about the sources, like oil and gas waste are just concentrations of things in the environment that we're drilling for, like petroleum itself. Why we consider it an environmental contaminant, I mean, we have to mine the earth to get it. So same thing with a lot of these metals. The source of barium and arsenic and iron and aluminum, those are from the geology. You know, it's really when we concentrate these things to get at real high levels or a fast rate of exposure that we have like toxicological effects when we worry about it. So oil and gas wastes tend to concentrate these naturally occurring compounds in their waste stream.
Glass explains that the DEP's data indicates that these chemicals were present in the waste pit or impoundments. He also points out that this area of Loch Gelly is known to have environmental damage from other industrial activities.
There was this constant, you know, acid mine drainage looking flow coming right out at the base of that. And, you know, sometimes it was real dark and black, and sometimes it was orange, and it was these different colors, and sometimes it was associated with odors. They don't know that that's what smelled, but odors would be in the valley there, and people would look at that and put the two together. So that drove some sampling.
Identifying some of the chemicals contained in the pit will help regulators and scientists know what to look for in the environment to determine any possible contamination. So samples were taken from water sources in areas around the pit in those same years.
Basically, what our data found is that some of the things that are also contained in the pit have also been found outside of the pit, and they appear to increase, for certain parameters, they appear to increase as you move down gradient from the pit.
Glass says the same contents that were found in the pit were also found in the stream samples taken next to the pit, although at lower concentration levels and below the standard set by the Safe Drinking Water Act.
It looks generally like some of the key indicators that would be specific to oil and gas tend to increase as you move down gradient from the pit on Danny Webb's site.
The data suggests that the pit could have been leaking, but it's not conclusive. Remember, some of the findings are naturally occurring. Still, one compound that is not naturally occurring and commonly found in oil and gas waste is glycol.
Glycols, the one time we looked for them, we found them. Just to be fair, at the same time, you know, this is kind of like a runover area. There's a lot of things. I mean, for all I know, there's some old piece of mining equipment sitting up on the stream that has a radiator full of antifreeze, glycols, and it's leaking out. And that's what I'm seeing in my results. So you really got to put them in perspective, you know. But what it says is, okay, let's start sampling for glycols.
Glycols aren't found in acid mine drainage either. These tests were done in April 2013. But Glass says it's still not conclusive.
And again, these sample locations are just, they're not necessarily GPS locations, and they're not related to like some significant feature that you can tell about. They're just like anecdotal, like next to pit, by pit, near pit, upstream from pit, downstream from pit.
Still, Glass says these tests were enough to raise concern and request more testing from the DEP. Within the past year, the regulatory agency ordered the pit closed and revoked the permit, citing significant public interest and procedural issues. On Thursday, the DEP Quality Control Board will hear arguments from Tom Rist, an attorney representing the Natural Resource Defense Council, Plateau Action Network, and citizen Brad Keenan. DEP inspectors say that Danny Webb was allowed to accept waste while the permit was in the renewal process. Tom Rist and his clients disagree and say that's against the law. Glass says the process seems to be a loophole that disregards public health.
Yeah, I think you should close that loop. You know, you should prepare your application prior to your old one expiring. I don't really see a reason for a gap between the two. So, no, I don't think they should be accepting waste if they're not permitted, unless it's maintained under some sort of formal extension that enforces all the permit requirements that were in place with the prior permit.
The Natural Resource Defense Council says federal law that governs hazardous waste has a loophole for oil and gas waste that was created in the 1980s through an amendment to the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. The Cleaner Act, however, or the Closing Loopholes and Ending Arbitrary and Needless Evasion of the Regulatory Act of 2013, is meant to close that loophole. DEP reports that solid waste from the pits was taken to the Raleigh County landfill. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jessica Lilly.
Well, there's been much deliberation over the last week regarding new Environmental Protection Agency proposals for regulating coal-fired power plant carbon emissions. State officials are very discouraged by the ideas. But as Beneduccio reports, there are also proposals on the table for how to regulate future power plants, and some are asking whether any will be built again in West Virginia.
The EPA has issued new ideas on how to regulate existing power plants, which would call for a 30% national reduction on carbon emissions by 2030 from 2005 levels. Congressman David McKinley and Nick Rayall co-introduced legislation to essentially strike down not only emissions standards concerning current power plants, but additional proposals that would apply to future power plants. Those standards came out last year and would require new plants to use cleaner methods like carbon capture and storage and natural gas technologies to ensure fewer carbon emissions into the air. Jamie Van Nostrand with the West Virginia University Center for Energy and Sustainable Development says these new technologies will present many challenges for anyone wanting to build a new power plant.
It's very difficult given the rules under 111B, which really restrict the greenhouse gas emissions associated with new power plants and pretty much require carbon capture and sequestration either through a gasification process before you generate electricity or capturing and sequestering it afterwards. And it's very, very expensive, particularly in the absence of having enhanced oil recovery nearby.
Van Nostrand says a plant in Canada is capturing nearly all of its greenhouse gas emissions but it has oil recovery technologies nearby that allow it to do that work. He says despite the challenges, it can be done.
The CCS technology is continuing to improve. There's a lot of money being spent on clean coal technology, and I think the expectation is down the road, the EPA regulations under 111B may drive the technological advances that would allow a coal plant to be constructed in the future.
Carbon capture and storage has been called not commercially viable at the moment by many people in the coal industry, but it's been tried and accomplished in West Virginia before. American Electric Power piloted a carbon capture project within the last 5 years. It captured a significant portion of its carbon emissions before it was to be released, and then it injected it into a deep well to store it. It cannot be implemented system-wide, according to company officials, because of a lack of funding support from Congress and a lack of interest from public service commissions. Jeffrey LaFleur with American Electric Power told West Virginia Public Radio in May that the technology needs more funding and research.
I think we would be a lot further down the road now if we would have had a better, a little more foresight on the government's part to, you know, fully develop the technology. I mean, the real big debate now is, you know, for new coal units, the EPA proposed rule is you'll have to have carbon capture to build a new coal plant. And because all of this was kind of stopped, you know, that technology really isn't commercially available.
Regardless of what proposals do eventually go into effect, there is resistance from many in West Virginia to these strategies. Political leaders have used the term war on coal to describe the EPA's efforts on carbon emission restrictions. House Bill 4813, co-sponsored by Ray Hall, a Democrat, and McKinley, a Republican, would not only strike down new rules, it also aims to block the issuance of similar rules for at least the next 5 years without congressional approval. Jamie Van Nostrand.
It's very politically divisive, that's for sure. But there's a lot of consequences for politicians who sort of speak out on the issue of climate change. I think it's frustrating that we haven't been able to get any climate energy legislation through the Congress and the Senate.
Van Nostrand and the West Virginia University Center for Energy and Sustainable Development, along with Downstream Strategies, an environmental consulting firm, are working on a report to show policymakers in the state how West Virginia can best meet new EPA proposals on existing plants. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Beneduccio in Morgantown.
And this is West Virginia Morning. It's 7:42. Some dense fog this morning with a chance of rain and thunderstorms today. Heavy rain is possible. Temperatures in the 70s and 80s. Heavy rain in the forecast tonight as well, with lows in the 50s and 60s. And for Thursday, rain and thunderstorms continue with highs in the 70s and 80s.
Support for West Virginia Public Radio is provided by Festival Charleston, June 20th through the 29th, with Aaron Neville at the Mayor's Concert in the Clay Center. FestivalCharleston.com. West Virginia, wild and wonderful.
Yesterday, we heard a report about a fledging nonprofit that's working toward the goal of creating a thriving local food economy in the Northern Panhandle. Grow Ohio Valley was recently awarded more than $150,000 to put their ideas in motion. Today, Glennis Board continues her investigation into what some of these plans entail. She brings us this report.
So, I am bushwhacking my way through Wheeling, the city of Wheeling. If I didn't know better, I'd say the zombie apocalypse had come and gone.
So we're walking, it looks like we're in the woods, but you notice that there's still like streetlights in this path through the woods. So this was a neighborhood that was all torn down 40 years ago and is now regrown up into a 40-year-old forest. An interesting forest because it's got a lot of non-native species that were here from the neighborhood. Like this is all Rose of Sharon here growing along the old roadside.
That's Danny Swan, co-founder of a new nonprofit called Grow Ohio Valley. He came to Wheeling through Jesuit University. He hails from Morgantown. He's really passionate about growing food, educating youth, and about his community.
And then if you peek back through the weeds and the trees, you'll see that there's old staircases and foundations.
Oh my God.
Yeah, and it's like all old.
Look at that.
It's like Roman ruins, you know. It's really cool. It's like.
And how did you discover this?
Just walking the dog. And it's we're right here in downtown Wheeling. So if we just walked a little bit forward, or in fact, if there weren't leaves on the trees right now, what you'd see right there is all of downtown Wheeling. If you had a good arm, you could throw a rock and hit the cathedral downtown.
Really?
It's
But you cannot tell.
Yeah, you're right here in the middle of the woods. It's one of the coolest places I know of, and one of the coolest places in Wheeling. It kind of has a Chronicles of Narnia feel, doesn't it? It's pretty weird, yeah. If you just talk to the weird.
Swan explains landslides on this steeply sloped hillside made the buildings too expensive to maintain. It's totally abandoned here. Now, I grew up in this town, but I have never been here or heard of this place. I've never seen this side of Wheeling, and it's not as if there's nothing to see.
This was apartment buildings where we stand now. So we're standing in a meadow. It's a little more than an acre. And what we see in front of us as we look off to the west is basically all of downtown Wheeling. So there's the arena and the waterfront park, and there's the river behind it. And on the other side, you can see all the way down to Bel Air and up to Martin's Ferry. It's this incredible view, one-of-a-kind view.
It feels somehow like walking back in time. The old Victorian buildings, the mighty Ohio River stretched out as far as you can see. It all looks like one of those tinny, old-time photos you would see framed in a postcard or in a history museum. But it's real. And in years of coming here, Swan says he has never come across anyone else hiking through. Never. And his organization, Grow Ohio Valley, have a plan. They want to take the existing elements here, the overgrown roads and these pretty much perfect public stairways with handrails that traverse the entire hill, and turn them into nature trails, complete with historical and informative signage. And then create a teaching garden in the meadow that overlooks the Ohio Valley. It's actually a convenient location because just up the hill, a little further, is a building that was just gifted to Grow Ohio Valley.
My name is Brandon Holmes, and we are at the future location of Friendly City Foods and also the offices of Grow Ohio Valley.
Holmes is currently covered in drywall dust because he and other volunteers are working on renovating this building. Holmes is a policy analyst for the West Virginia Food and Farm Coalition. He's also on the steering committee of Grow Ohio Valley and the project manager of Friendly City Foods. Grow Ohio Valley is taking a page from the Wild Ramp in Huntington and creating this year-round consignment farmers market / retail, local, healthy, natural food store slated to open in July.
We want farmers to be able to come, drop off what they've grown, and not only farmers, but also backyard gardeners, market gardeners, those people that have, you know, an extra half a bushel of tomatoes or zucchini or something that they really did well on. We want them to be able to drop those products off here. We'll sell those products. We'll take a commission off of them, and then they'll be able to go and do what they do best, which is grow, instead of sitting on the side of the road or sitting at the farmer's market waiting on someone to come and buy their products.
Right. This building will also serve as a distribution spot for Grow OV's Super CSA, entitled Black Swan Organics. For those who are unfamiliar, CSA stands for Community Sustained Agriculture. It's where individuals purchase a subscription and gain access to weekly distributions of produce from local farmers or producers. Distribution is scheduled to begin here on June 18th. So, community gardens, like Farm 18, the 18th Street Mega Community Garden, Friendly City Foods, the Consignment Farmers Market, Lincoln Meadow, which is the inner city growing garden / nature preserve I introduced you to today. Yeah, that's close to about half of what Grow Ohio Valley is up to. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Wheeling.
And you can tune in tomorrow to hear our final installment of how this nonprofit, Grow Ohio Valley, is growing a local food economy in the Northern Panhandle. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Keep up with all the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. We're interested in your comments. You can send them to feedback@wvpublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at @WVPublicNews and find us on Facebook. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Beneduccio. Our director is Teresa Wills. I'm Beth Voorhees.